Hello. Welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. And on this last day of the month of March, we begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes the following names: Matthew Coates, 50, of Chandler; Jean Miller Palumbo, 71, of Phoenix; Bonnie Mae Goles Reno, 99, of Mesa; and Gary Lee Todd Jr., 59, of Scottsdale. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. We turn now to the business section of the paper. It looks like there's three articles on this page. At the top of the page, Trump praises Sharpies at cabinet meeting. This is written by Bart Jansen for the USA Today out of Washington. While juggling a war in Iran and the partial shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security, President Donald Trump took time during a cabinet meeting to lavish praise on Sharpie pens. Trump began the digression reluctantly, saying he didn't want to give the company too much publicity. But then he went on a jocular ramble about how much better the black markers are for signing official documents than the White House's standard-issue ballpoint pens. Trump said, quote, "This pen is very inexpensive, but it writes well. I like it. I don't want to give them too much publicity, but they do tip me well, Sharpie," unquote. The stock price of Newell Brands, which is the parent company of Sharpie, jumped while Trump spoke. Trump indicated to reporters assembled to hear about war and national security that the pen had a mightier grip on his attention. The ballpoint pens he was initially provided in the Oval Office came in gold and silver and were gorgeous, he said. But Trump noted they occasionally would not write when the eyes of the world were on him, signing legislation or executive orders. So Trump told the reporters in the cabinet room, quote, "They didn't write well. I take it out and I sign and there's no ink. I got all you people looking. There must be something wrong with Trump." Trump said another concern for him was that the ballpoint pens cost $1,000 apiece, and he might hand out 30 or 40 at a signing, he said. And then someone would ask for five more, and children didn't understand what the big deal was. So Trump said, quote, "I'm handing them out to kids who don't even know what it is. What is this, Mommy? These kids are getting a pen for $1,000 apiece, and they don't know what it is," unquote. Trump remains a Sharpie enthusiast, despite weathering criticism during his first term for using one to doctor the map of Hurricane Dorian's predicted path. Trump said he called the head of Sharpie to ask about possible alterations. And that was Trump praises Sharpies at cabinet meeting. Our second article from the business page, SpaceX stirs up frenzy with IPO. This was written by Niket Nishant and Shaswat Chuhan. Those are reporters for the Reuters News Group. From rocket launches drawing millions of YouTube views to social media frenzy over its potential listing, SpaceX debut is shaping up to be a landmark moment for Wall Street. Traders are betting thousands of dollars on the company's ticker and speculating over its entry into the most elite club of U.S. companies, giving the world's most valuable startup a level of social media buzz that only a few companies enjoy, especially when they are yet to file their IPO paperwork. On Polymarket, users were betting on topics including the company's targeted valuation, the exchange that it will list on, and the ticker its shares would trade under. The combined trading volume of such bets exceeded more than $15.2 million as of March 27th. Odds on the prediction markets platform put a 25% chance on SpaceX choosing the letter X as its ticker. That's a sharp drop from 60% a month ago. The single letter ticker is up for grabs after U.S. Steel, which reportedly held it for over a century, delisted from the New York Stock Exchange after being bought by Japan's Nippon Steel in 2025. Musk's social media platform is also called X after a rebrand from Twitter in 2023. Tuttle Capital Management CEO Matthew Tuttle said a better alternative would be SPCX, and also the ticker of an exchange-traded fund that his company manages. Tuttle was open to selling the SPCX symbol to SpaceX. He said, quote, "I've not heard from Elon, but my phone line is still open, and I'm holding out hope that I get a call," unquote. Apart from X, other potential options floated on Polymarket include SPAX and the risque SEX. However, users see a roughly 70% probability that the company chooses a different ticker altogether. SpaceX is targeting a valuation of $1.75 trillion in its listing, which would make it the sixth biggest U.S. company by market capitalization. Tesla and Meta platforms could fall behind, with market valuations of $1.4 trillion and $1.39 trillion, respectively. And that has fueled speculation over whether the company's market debut will force a rethink of the so-called Magnificent Seven, a group of some of the most valuable U.S. companies. Todd Schoenberger, chief investment officer at Crosscheck Management, Todd said, quote, "When the company does finally go public, the Magnificent Seven will clearly expand. They'll probably call it the Magnificent Eight or the Super Eight or some other new acronym," unquote. To capitalize on his popularity among retail investors, CEO Elon Musk is also discussing allocating as much as 30% of the IPO to individual investors. And that's at least three times the usual retail slice, according to Reuters. On Reddit's R Wall Street Bets thread, SpaceX was mentioned 130 times over the past week and was the 19th most popular mention, according to the data from the Germany-based data group Breakout Point. And that was SpaceX. SpaceX stirs up frenzy with IPO. Our third article from the business section of the paper. Research seeks alternative to thirsty crops for cattle. This is written by Brandon Loomis for the Arizona Republic from Fruta, Colorado. The green shoots that rise from the soil under Perry Cabot's cultivation look a little different from the standard brushy bunches of alfalfa and other cattle forage crops growing on the flats here north of the Colorado River. With names like Sainfoin and Kernza, the latter is a selectively bred wheatgrass with a registered trademark, they leaf out like sage on flowering spears that grow upward on grass stalks that will eventually produce a grain head. The other difference is how they look when perking up after overwintering in a drought year. Where Sainfoin and alfalfa blanket the field in adjacent plots, Sainfoin greens up while the alfalfa remains yellow. Now Cabot, who's an extension professor and an irrigation specialist with Colorado State University, Cabot said, quote, "The plant tells the story," unquote. The story that he and the colleagues at the Western Colorado Research Center's Grand Valley Farm are trying to narrate is one of a future in which farmers and ranchers have alternative forage crops to help them survive drought and the intensifying tug of war between Colorado River water users. Alfalfa and grass haze are the biggest drain on the Colorado River, using as much as 46% of the water. When Colorado State and partners started considering these alternative crops, Cabot said the talk was of plants that could greatly reduce irrigation needs season in and season out, all while providing the same yield as alfalfa. "Well, that seems unlikely," he said. Quote, "There's not really a free lunch out there," unquote. But what these alternatives might promise is greater flexibility in both markets and the ability to bounce back from drought years or compensated following. That practice has spread across the West as the river has contracted. But it also invites opposition in rural communities. The government has paid farmers to temporarily keep water off of some fields so it can instead flow toward Lake Powell and Lake Mead to restock dwindling water storage. It has helped keep those reservoirs from dropping to catastrophic levels. But it also creates fear that it could become permanent and dry up the farm economies. The alternative crops could aid farmers who want to participate. They generally don't require replanting, and their quick rebound once water is reapplied means that producers won't miss a beat once their fallowing deal is expired. And that's why conservation groups, including American Rivers, have collaborated with Colorado State on these tests. Hannah Holm, a partner in the project and the associate director for policy in the group's Southwest region, said, quote, "If people have something more resilient like that, they might be less reluctant to participate," unquote. Her employer wants to reduce pressure on rivers, she said, but to do so in collaboration with those who need the water. Testing crops like these is one way to learn new ways of preserving farms and farm towns in a drying region. If these fail to do the trick, maybe others will work. She said, quote, "If we want our rural communities and our rivers to keep thriving, we've got to try different things," unquote. Many irrigators along Colorado's tributary streams get cut off early in dry years when there's not enough water to satisfy all the legal rights to it. Some might get only a quarter of what they would otherwise expect to use, Cabot said. While alternative crops may not yield the same yield in wet year, they could do better than alfalfa in a dry year. Cabot said, quote, "They're going to get nothing from alfalfa after curtailment, but they could have sainfoin in their field and get something from it, maybe," unquote. Now, on the market side, these crops give farmers options. For instance, sainfoin leaves reduce bloating that cows might experience while eating pure alfalfa. Feeding sainfoin to cattle or mixing it with alfalfa can improve health while reducing methane emissions that get part of the blame for the climate warming that's shrinking the snowpack that supplies the river. Kernza offers the option of selling an altogether different product when prices dictate. Although cows can eat it, it's also used in beer and cereals and other grain-based foods. So whether these particular alternative forage crops are the ones that growers ultimately embrace, something has to change on the farms as water in the West becomes more precious and contentious. Using such a large share of the river for cattle feed probably is not sustainable. Holmes said, quote, "What we've been doing is not going to work, and I don't think we're going to be allowed to keep doing it," unquote. And that was the article, "Research Seeks Alternative to Thirsty Crops for Cattle." We're coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, so we're going to leave the business section and move on over to the sports section of the paper. Well, on the front page of the sports section, there's a big picture covering three of the four columns across the page, and it's a picture of the floor of the basketball arena for the Final Four of the Women's NCAA Tournament. and it shows the logo in the center of the floor. Above the picture, it's a really good nod to the city of Phoenix. And below the picture, there are two articles. And the first one we're going to read is by Jenna Ortiz, and her subtitle is Arizona Featured in Women's Final Four Court. From the forest in Michigan to the hardwood showcasing the best in women's basketball, the Women's Final Four Court undergoes a year-long process before it is turned into a colorful display of teal and orange and blue and red. But once the court is installed at Mortgage Matchup Center, one more vital step will have to be taken. The long-anticipated Final Four is now just days away, beginning on Friday, April 3rd. The UConn Huskies and the UCLA Bruins punched their tickets on March 29th, with the two other games, the number one regional seed Texas versus number two Michigan, and the number one seed South Carolina versus number three seed TCU. Those are set to be played later on Monday, March 30th. The four teams will find a unique basketball court. Jay Perry, who is CEO of Phoenix's Final Four Local Organizing Committee, he said, quote, "I walked in and it was like an aha moment for me. We've been planning this for 18 months with the NCAA, and now to walk in on Monday morning on championship week and see this, it's real and it's happening," unquote. The Final Four tabbed Connor Sports, the official court supplier of the NCAA Final Four since 2006, to follow the NCAA's style guidelines and add Arizona-inspired flair. NCAA Director of Women's Basketball Amy Rice said, quote, "It really starts with an idea. What do we want to highlight? What do we want to show? What can make it feel very Arizona and Phoenix specific?" Unquote. One aspect that's important to Arizona is connecting with the indigenous community through design, including mosaic-like patterns on the court. Reese said, quote, "You can feel the colors. You can feel the energy. You can feel the teal coming out, which is really a capstone color. The colors are molding together and blending," unquote. So as the design process was ongoing, the court was growing in the forest of Michigan before the raw materials were shipped to Connor Sports Mill in late 2025. The manufacturing process continued through January as the raw wood became the 262 panels, 4 feet by 7 feet, that are used for the Final Four court. The panels were then shipped to partners in early February for the finishing process of sanding and painting, sealing and curing. And the court was then sent to Phoenix and installed panel by panel by technicians in a 4-hour process. The court is estimated to have traveled 2,483 miles, and it weighs around 42,500 pounds. Connor Sports Marketing Director Zach Riberty said, quote, "It's a labor of love that started a long time ago, and I can't believe how beautiful it turned out. The women's court design this year looks prettier to me than the ones we have done in years past. I think all of the colors pop really well. It's a really good nod to the city of Phoenix," unquote. And that was the big picture of the Final Four court, underneath the big headlines of "It's a really good nod to the city of Phoenix," and the subtitle for the first article was "Arizona Featured in Women's Final Four Court" by Jenna Ortiz. Now the second article underneath that big picture is UCLA veterans sparked comeback against Duke. And this was written by Sydney Henderson for the USA Today out of Sacramento. UCLA women's basketball is still dancing in the 2026 women's NCAA tournament, literally, after number one UCLA defeated number three Duke 70-58 in the Elite Eight on March 29th. Seniors Lauren Betts, Charlize Leger-Walker, and Gabriela Jaquez gave an encore performance of their choreographed dance in front of family and friends. There is a lot to celebrate. UCLA is headed back to the Final Four for the second consecutive season. Lauren Betts said, quote, "We did the viral dance in the locker room today as well. I didn't realize they were going to play on the court in front of everybody." And then Gabs, of course, comes running over. Like the song name, fans get to keep watching UCLA as their March Madness run continues. And although the dance break marked a moment of pure jubilation for the Bruins, Betts experienced the opposite side of the spectrum just hours prior. She said, "I was just pretty mad. I just didn't like how that first half happened. This is the Elite Eight, and my senior season is on the line." The matchup between UCLA and Duke at the Golden One Center on Sunday was a tale of two halves. The Sun Devils led by as many as 10 points in the first half, and the Bruins entered the locker room trailing for only the second time all season. UCLA completely flipped the script in the third quarter, and they went on to outscore Duke 39-19 in the second half to complete the comeback victory and keep their season alive. But the Bruins did not need head coach Corey Close to master up a motivational halftime speech to rally the troops. UCLA, made up of 8 seniors, including all 5 of their starters, had already taken care of things and discussed the adjustments long before Coach Close stepped into the locker room. Experience was on their side. Now Betts, who is the Sacramento Regional No. 2's most outstanding player, Betts said, quote, "We could have gone into that locker room and just kept our head down and gotten mad at each other and been pissed off, but we want to win. I spoke to all the girls, and I held people accountable, and I think I just came out with the mentality I'm just not going to lose. And so whether that's me scoring or blocking shots or getting extra rebounds, I was willing to do whatever the team needed," unquote. Senior forward Angela Dugalik, who was named to the Sacramento Regional 2 All-Tournament team, said the team's defensive effort was the first topic of conversation. Dugalik said, quote, "We try to anchor ourselves on defense, and we knew that wasn't a great depiction of how we want to play defense, so I think we just needed to adjust. I even told the guards, I need you guys to get through the screen so we can properly help you guys and get back to our player." And then they had some things to say to us as well. Close had leaned on her team's veteran leadership all season and trust their instincts to get back to the fundamentals, although she did joke that she would much rather have her players listen to me before we went out and follow the game plan from the beginning. Close said her main role at halftime was to bring a sense of calmness. Coach Close said, quote, "I was going into the locker room, talking to myself, going, they've got this. Be solid. Stay really steady for them. When you have a mature group, and when your culture is pretty intact in terms of the values, it's better for me to be quick to listen and slow to speak. So usually, when I speak, I will have better things to say," unquote. Well, UCLA will face the winner of No. 1 Texas versus No. 2 Michigan at the Final Four in Phoenix on April 3rd. And that was UCLA veterans' sparked comeback against Duke. Then, on the side of the fourth column, there's a little more basketball news, but it's about high school. Richard Obert wrote this for the Arizona Republic, "St. Mary's star in spotlight." The McDonald's All-American High School basketball game comes to Arizona this week for the first time, and Phoenix St. Mary's 7-footer Cameron Williams is ready for the national spotlight. Williams averaged 25 points and 12 rebounds this season and led to St. Mary's to the Open Division State Final where they fell to Sunny Slope. He will be among top high school seniors featured in the game on Tuesday night, March 31st at 6 p.m. at Desert Diamond Arena in Glendale. The girls' game will precede it at 4 p.m. ESPN is televising both games. Williams will be playing for the West team. That includes Tyrann Stokes, the number one ranked player in the 2026 class out of Rainier Beach High in Washington. Williams has committed to Duke for next season. He wants to show the school what they are getting. He said, quote, "I'm going to try and win the game. My main focus is doing really well in the practices," unquote. Plenty of family and friends will be on hand cheering for Williams, who catapulted onto the national scene in the last 2 years. He led St. Mary's to the 4A championship in 2025, and this week he was named to the Republic's All-Arizona team for a second straight year. He was also named the Gatorade Arizona Player of the Year, and he was among three finalists for the national honor. Being named to the McDonald's game was the biggest of his high school goals. Williams said, quote, "I definitely want to play hard for the people who come out and have supported me," unquote. Williams, who started out at Peoria Centennial his freshman year before transferring to St. Mary's as a sophomore, came into his senior year ranked number two nationally in the 2026 class by ESPN after an impressive summer at national camps and showcases. He lived up to that ranking during the season, showing off an assortment of dunks, dominating defensively, and moving his game beyond the three-point arc. Now, as a sophomore, he was already a good shot blocker, but he was learning to dunk and make free throws. He put in the work, and it showed in both areas. St. Mary's coach, Damon Lopez, said, quote, "I could tell right away he had immense talent. The second he stepped foot on campus, you could see that Cam had the frame and the mindset to be a really special player. He was a little late bloomer. He wasn't as refined as some of the kids his age. But we knew that if we could continue to work on his fundamentals, once his athleticism kicked in, he would be a tremendous player," unquote. On January 19th, in the Hoop Hall Classic in Massachusetts, Williams had an efficient 31 points in a close loss to Virginia's Paul VI, which was the number one ranked team nationally by Max Preps. He made 12 of 18 shots and 4 of 7 three-pointers. Williams said, quote, "I just want to make the most out of every moment. All of the camps I do, when I get to Duke, I want them to see the best of me, that I didn't take for granted any day on the court," unquote. Lopez has no doubt he'll be seeing Williams play in high-leverage games for Duke and in the NBA. Lopez said, quote, "We knew it was going to be a process with Williams. We were pretty clear with the family with that, what that looked like. They were on board with everything, and everything worked out perfectly for him," unquote. And that was the article, St. Mary's Star in Spotlight. Then, a little bit about the men's NCAA tournament. This is the third article from the front page of the sports section, written by Bruce Pasco for the Arizona Daily Star. Good health powers U of A's rotation on run to Final Four. This comes from San Jose, California. Because the Wildcats have stayed nearly injury-free all season, Arizona trainer Justin Kokoschi could probably take a little credit for their 36 wins and their Final Four berth. But he won't. Kokoschi said, quote, "There are so many people involved with this. Tucson is a small community, and they allow us to use the best doctors in town. I have a Rolodex of hundreds of doctors and people that I call, and they are awesome people." On Friday night, March 27th, quote, "Doctors were calling me, my medical staff, our athletic trainers. They all want to pitch in and help. It's a team effort, to be honest. I have all the resources I need on my phone with the doctors and the athletic trainers. So we make the most of what we have. It is a phenomenal group to work with, unquote. Freshman forward Koa Pete was the only one of U of A's 8 rotation players to miss time because of injury all season, and he missed just 3.5 games after leaving U of A's February 14th loss to Texas Tech with a lower leg injury. Freshman forward Dwayne Aristode also missed the Texas Tech game and the next 3 because of an illness. But other than that, nobody in the rotation missed a regular season game. Toby Awaka sat out an exhibition game while Kokoski and U of A staffers helped both wing Anthony DeLorso and Ivan Karchnikov recover from mid-tier ankle injuries in time to return for the Wildcats' next games. In addition, even though the Wildcats lost to Texas Tech when Pete went out and Aristode was already missing, they may have grown by learning how to deal with it. At less than full strength, Arizona beat BYU at home on February 18th, and they won at Houston 3 days later without Pete or Aristode. Forwards Toby Awaka, Anthony DeLorso, and Ivan Karchnikov all played bigger roles without the 2 missing players. That's a process that Awaka said helped the team grow in the long term. On March 28th, Awaka said, quote, "For sure, it kind of makes you ready for moments like this," unquote. Held to just 2 points over 2 games against Washington State and Oscar Clough 2 seasons ago, Arizona center Motiejus Krivas did not appear surprised to see once unknown college Cochise College center Oscar Clough collect 14 points and 10 rebounds against the Wildcats on March 28th. Krivas said, "I remember he was really strong." Clough's rise at Washington State, which beat Arizona twice in 23 and 24, led to a featured role at South Dakota State last season when he averaged 17.6 points and 12.3 rebounds per game. Clough then hit the transfer portal again last spring, and he signed on at Purdue for this season, giving the Boilermakers a tough inside presence that they lacked since Zach Eddy left after their 2024 Final Four. Clough averaged 10.6 points and 7.5 rebounds while starting all 39 games for the Boilermakers this season. Purdue coach Matt Painter said, quote, "He was great for us. He gave us what we needed. Second in the nation in rebounding last year at South Dakota State. Great attitude. Tough dude. He fit in. OC was fabulous for us. Man, he will compete. He'll foul you about 15 times in the game, too. He's going to lay it on the line. He's going to hit. He loves the physicality of the game. He's been great for us. He's a good dude to be around," unquote. Well, despite growing up down under, where March Madness isn't much of a thing, Anthony DeLorso has a pretty good grasp on how it works. The Aussie wing knew even beating Florida, UConn, and UCLA to begin the season, and then winning the Big 12 meant nothing once the do-or-die NCAA tournament began. DeLorso said, quote, "You see every year different teams make it to the Final Four. We may have been one of the greatest teams all year, but when it gets to March, it's anything could happen. You saw Florida lost, and Florida's a great team. If they happen to lose, nothing's guaranteed. That's what makes it so special," unquote. So when DeLorso transferred to Arizona from low major Campbell in 2024, he said he did not envision going to the Final Four, and then it happened. DeLorso said, quote, "I had no idea. When everyone answers the transfer portal, they immediately think of themselves and what can they get. I came here expecting to play in March and get all the stuff that Arizona brings. But to be here in this moment, you can never predict that," unquote. Among the other Wildcats pierced with emotion with their advancement to the Final Four, former walk-on guard Grant Whiteman, a Tucson local, who literally was born into the program with a grandfather who was a close friend of former coach Lute Olson. Kokowski said, quote, Grant was in the hotel. His family was in the hotel. And he's crying after the game. I was looking up in a crowd after the game, and our donors are all full-out tears, unquote. Well, after winning two games in the Big Ten tournament by an average of 3.5 points and losing to Purdue in the conference tournament final, Michigan is back to its old dominant self. The Wolverines pummeled the number 6 seed Tennessee 95-62 to win the Midwest Regional and the right to face Arizona in the national semifinals on Saturday, April 4th at Indianapolis. They won their first four NCAA tournament games by an average of 22.5 points. Michigan rose to prominence this season by winning three Players Era Festival games against San Diego State, Auburn, and Gonzaga by an average of 33 points, and then won the Big Ten regular season title by four games. On March 29th, they went on a 24-2 run after trailing by 2 points early in the game. It was never the same afterward. Michigan coach Dusty May said, quote, the game got loosened up, and I want to give our staff a lot of credit. They managed the foul trouble and the minutes as well as we have all year. That was a big part of it. I think the beautiful brand of basketball we were playing became contagious. You could see these guys feeding off of each other, unquote. And that was the article, Good Health Powers U of A Rotation on Run to Final Four. Well, at 36 minutes past the hour, we finished the front page of the sports section. Let's turn the page and see if there's another article or two that we can read in there. How about an article about racing? Elliott earns Chevy's first win of 2026. This is by Field Level Media. Chase Elliott wasn't better than Denny Hamlin for the majority of Sunday's Cookout 400, but he was when it mattered the most. The 8-time NASCAR most popular driver used pit strategy, staying out ahead of the dominant Denny Hamlin, and finally put Chevrolet into victory lane by winning at the half-mile Martinsville Speedway in Martinsville, Virginia. Elliott short-pitted from 9th place on lap 261, took advantage of a caution for debris, and beat the Joe Gibbs Racing driver by 0.565 seconds to give Chevrolet the checkers for the first time in 7 races in 2026. He led twice for 84 laps in his 22nd career victory and second at the tight bullring. Elliott, who also won at the track on November 1st back in 2020, said, quote, it was definitely a team effort. We've never had a win this early in the season. We took a gamble. We were going to two-stop that last stage, and I honestly think it was going to work out for us either way. It sure is a lot of fun when days like this work out, unquote. Chevrolet earned its 7th win in the past 12 Martinsville races. Hamlin torched the field by leading 292 laps, but he banged into Ryan Blaney's number 12 on the front stretch on lap 334 while chasing Elliott. Hamlin said, quote, he did a good job of controlling the pace there. It really came from that bad restart I had beside Ross Chastain, and not really much I could have done there. I thought I had a loose wheel. It felt similar to Darlington in the back. These are just some of the races that get away from you in your career. This is one of them, certainly. Unquote. Joey Logano, Ty Gibbs, and William Byron rounded out the top 5 finishers. Brad Keselowski became the 36th driver in NASCAR history to make 600 career starts, and he came home in 13th in his number 6 RFK Racing Ford. After scoring his 5th pole at the Virginia short track, Hamlin led the first 38 circuits before his number 11 Toyota caught the tail end of the field, which allowed Byron's Chevrolet to squeeze by for 6 laps before Hamlin regained the point. Stage 1 ended under caution, with Hamlin leading 74 of the 80 laps. trailing second place Byron were Josh Berry, Gibbs, and Austin Chindrick as the field prepared for the first round of pit stops. Hamlin continued to pace the way by just more than a second 150 laps in, but all three Penske drivers, Logano, Cendric, and Ryan Blaney, came alive and gridded inside the top five with Berry's number one Wood Brothers Ford in 10th. Toyota claimed the first two spots in Stage 2, Hamlin winning again, and then Gibbs, and the Fords of Logano and Blaney followed distantly, and Byron was fifth. With 200 laps to go, the Hendrick Motorsports Chevrolets of Larson, Elliott, and Byron were in the top 10, chasing the leader Hamlin. Elliott took advantage of the pit cycle to lead, but Hamlin's Camry shot by him with 93 laps remaining. And then caution 4 flew on lap 312 for debris, putting Elliott's number 9 Hendrick Motorsport Chevy in the second position ahead of Blaney, Gibbs, and Christopher Bell. And that was the article, Elliott Earns Chevy's First Win of 2026. And something about an article about, golf? It's entitled, Kim Outduels Nelly on LPGA at the Ford, written by Beth Ann Nichols for Golf Week. The Ford Championship was a scorcher from start to finish. From the unseasonably high triple-digit temps to Lydia Ko's opening 60, and for a second consecutive week, a Hyo Jo Kim Nelly Korda duel. It was a feast of low scoring. Even the cut line of 5-under at Whirlwind Golf Club's Cattail Course outside Phoenix tied for the lowest on tour since 1980, sharing a record set at the 2024 Stanford-Portland Classic. Kim, the defending champion at the Ford, entered the final round with a 4-stroke lead over Korda after becoming the first player in LPGA history to card 2 61s in the same tournament, rounds 1 and 3. Her 54-hole 191 total set a new LPGA 54-hole scoring round. For a moment on Sunday, it looked like all of those records might not lead to the winner's circle after a double bogey on the 8th hole brought Korda to within one stroke. But the window was not open long enough. Back-to-back bogeys from Korda on numbers 9 and 10 gave Kim a 4-stroke lead with 7 holes to play. 30-year-old Kim, who says Korda is her favorite player, said, quote, "I actually wanted to ask Nelly how it feels to win back-to-back," unquote. Korda has made 3 starts this season, finishing 1, 2, and 2. Kim is the only player she has lost to in 2026. Korda joked after the round, quote, "I'm done playing with her," unquote. The former number one missed a couple of short putts and misfired with some short irons on Sunday before finishing eagle birdie on the last 2 holes to shoot 67 and finish 2 strokes back. Golf stats guru Justin Ray pointed out the last time a player won back-to-back on the LPGA with the same player finishing runner-up both weeks was back in 2001 when Annika Sorenstam beat C. Ray Pack. The second of those 2 weeks was the standard register ping. That's where Sorenstam shot 59 in the second round. After a 2025 LPGA season that took 10 months to get a 2-time winner, Kim came back to back in March, and now, a 9-time LPGA winner, this marks the first time she has won consecutive events on the LPGA, and the first time she has successfully defended a title. A 14-time winner on the KLPGA, 19-year-old Kim burst onto the worldwide stage with a 61 in the opening round of the 2014 Evian Championship, making her first LPGA title a major. She deferred LPGA membership until the 2015 season. Kim moved up to number 4 in the world, a career best, after her victory at the Fontinet Founders Cup behind Charlie Hull, Korda, and Gino Thitikul, and is projected to move up to third on Monday. She joins Inbee Park as the only player since 1980 to win in their teens, their 20s, and their 30s. On Thursday, Ko became only the eighth player in LPGA history to card a 60. She shot 69-68 over the weekend to finish solo fourth. Amateur Astris Talley, who won her last three junior starts, finished in a share of 29th. And that was the golf article, Kim Outduels Nelly on LPGA at the Ford. We're coming up on 46 minutes past the hour, so it's time to move on over to the entertainment section. We're going to begin by reading today's horoscopes. We're going to begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you trying to be useful when you are running on empty? The Virgo moon opposing Mars can pressure you to be productive. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, a communal agenda may conflict with your desires today. Feeling obligated to put your energy where the group is? For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st. Prepare for tension between your private and public lives. The Virgo moon testing Mars can pull you in opposite directions. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd. Are you waiting for clear answers before you make a move? Release the need to have everything figured out. For Leos, birthdates from July 23rd through August 22nd, financial entanglements may require action today. Attend to money and resource issues. For you fellow Virgos out there, birthdates from August 23rd through September 22nd, are you irritated with a relationship? The Virgo moon opposing Mars can bring a sense of misalignment. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, daily responsibilities may pull you forward even when you want to rest. Are you pushing through to meet external demands? For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, making moves towards your creative aspirations? A passion project may require all of your attention. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates, are you feeling pressured to be capable and composed? Putting your best face forward can be challenging when there is frustration within. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates, watch for scattering your energy today. Mental fatigue from information overload is possible. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birthdates. Are you feeling financial frustration? You may feel like you are giving more than you are taking. And finally, Pisces, birthdates from February 19th to March 20th. A partner's needs may be at odds with your personal agenda. Is irritation or defensiveness your initial response? And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren in her column, Dear Abby. The first letter goes like this. Dear Abby, my wife and I are disgusted by something we and our grandson have never before encountered. Our ex-daughter-in-law of 10 years recently told our 16-year-old grandson she kicked her latest boyfriend out because he would not have sex with her. Our grandson was very upset, as were we. Isn't this considered some sort of abuse? Our grandson and his brother haven't lived with their mother for the last 5 years because they were tired of her smoking, drinking, and revolving door of boyfriends. They live happily with their father and have little to do with their mother. Signed, Disgusted in Colorado. And Abby responds, Dear Disgusted, your grandson is a teenager. He isn't 8. that his mother would say what she did to him is surprising, but it wasn't abuse. Could she have been tipsy when she said it? Fortunately, your grandson no longer lives under her roof and has a father with better judgment. Count your blessings and let this pass. Dear Abby, my boyfriend carries his keys and several metal accessories on a carabiner, which is always clipped to his belt loop. He lives in my home and is a frequent passenger in my car. I have noticed that his key clip and other items are damaging the paint on my car and door frames at the house as he exits and enters. I have asked him to please remove the clip or make some other arrangement for his keys, and although he says he's working on the problem, nothing changes. I'm ready to refuse entry to this key monster. Advice? Signed, Dinged in Ohio. Abby responds, Dear Dinged, only this. It seems that your irresponsible boyfriend lacks respect for other people's property, or he would have dealt with this promptly. Estimate the cost of refinishing your car and door frames and then offer him the opportunity to settle up what he owes you, or tell him it's time to move. We've got another letter today. Dear Abby, one of our co-workers doesn't want to be a closer friend, even though at work we say we love each other. We want to take the friendship to a deeper level, but she hesitates when we try to hang out outside of work. She has a mansion that many people in our office have seen, but she hasn't invited us over. She will only go to the movies with us. We are worried it's because in a movie theater, we can't talk to her. Are we getting mixed messages, or are we coming on too strong? Signed, Girls at Work in Michigan. Dear girls, you are coming on way too strong. There are work relationships and personal relationships. They are not always interchangeable. The woman may love working with you, but to assume that it's okay to pressure her into inviting you to her home or to be grilled about her personal life is wrong. You may mean well, but you girls need to accept the relationship as it is. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren, who is also known as Jean Phillips. And Dear Abby was founded by her mother, Pauline Phillips. You can contact her. The easiest way is to go to her website, www.dearabby.com. And now we have time to look at some comics. In the comic strip Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall, Dagwood and Blondie have just gotten into bed. Dagwood's holding his phone and he says, I downloaded a white noise app to help us sleep better. And he punches a button. In the second frame, Blondie says, Is that the sound of hamburgers cooking in a skillet? And he looks at the phone and says, Yeah, hamburgers sizzling. And the last frame he says, Well, now how am I ever going to get to sleep? And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Zitz, drawn by Jerry Scott and Jim Borgman, in the first frame, Mom is in the kitchen. She's got a trash bag in one hand and a cleaning rag in the other, and she goes spotless. And the kitchen looks so nice and clean. In the second frame, she goes outside and drops the trash bag in the dumpster. The third frame, she comes inside and looks in the kitchen and gasps. Because it is a mess. There are pots and pans out. The drawers are open. And in the last frame, she says to her husband, my kitchen is possessed by an evil spirit. And he says, eventually he'll go off to haunt a college somewhere. And that was Zitz. And then, in the comic strip Beetle Bailey, drawn by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker, Lieutenant Fuzz has gone into General Halftrack's office, and he says, Sir, I need to speak to you about an office supply problem. And the general says, Hold on, my hearing aids needs adjusting. And then in the next frame he says, You may proceed. Unfortunately, it looks like he took his hearing aids out and set them on the desk. And that was Beetle Bailey. And in the comic strip Peanuts, drawn by Charles Schulz, we've got Charlie Brown on the pitcher's mound in the first frame, and he throws the ball. And in the second frame, pow, it's a line drive, knocks him off onto his back. In the third frame, he's laying on the pitcher's mound on his back, and he says, "Now, I know why we play baseball in the summer. When our shoes and socks get knocked off by a line drive, our feet don't get cold." And that was Peanuts. And then in the comic strip, Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, Mom and Dad, Dad's carrying a box. "I'm going to get the kids off their electronics tonight." And Mom says, "With that?" And Dad says, "Yes, what's more fun than an empty cardboard box in the center of the room?" And Mom walks away going, "They're not cats." And Dad says, "Yeah, cats are probably more cooperative." And that was Baby Blues. Well, before we go, let's wish happy birthday to some celebrities. Let's find out who's celebrating today. Happy birthday and congratulations to actress and singer Shirley Jones. She turns 92. The trumpet player Herb Alpert turns 91. Politician and lawyer Barney Frank turns 86. The actor Christopher Walken turns 83. Actor Gabe Kaplan turns 81. Actress Rhea Perlman turns 78. Actor Ewan McGregor turns 55. And actress and comedian Kate Micucci turns 46. And actress and online personality Lisa Koshy turns 30. Congratulations and happy birthday. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. Enjoy and make it a great day.